So first of all, I'd like to introduce Ghassan, who many of you will know, is the future generation professor of anthropology and social theory at the University of Melbourne. He's the author of many, many books, many famous books, many books that have made a kind of significant contribution to not just Australian intellectual life, but international fields. Most famously, of course, White Nation and Against Paranoid Nationalism. Most recently this year, the also controversial book, Alter Politics. Maybe we'll get to hear a bit about that today. And forthcoming is the provocatively and interestingly and rather oddly entitled Are Racists Responsible for Global Warming? Which I presume gets a yes or no answer on the second page. I'd also like to point out that it's always nice to have Ghassan come back to Western Sydney. And I mean the university, not the area. We had a bit of an exchange via email last night, which we won't get into last night. So, Ghassan, of course, was at this university many, many years ago. In fact, the institute that I now work at started life as a tiny little thing called the Research Centre for Intercommunal Studies, which Ghassan and Leslie Johnson began until he was seduced by a sandstone university, for which we bear no grudges, of course. Okay. Mohammed, again, I'm assuming all of you know, who's the director of Sweatshop, the Western Sydney Literacy Movement, and is also a doctoral candidate here in the Writing Society Research Centre. Many of you will know that Mohammed's debut novel, Tribe, was famously and well-received critically and popularly, and won many accolades and quite a few awards, and is still lined up for a few awards. His humility prevents me from listing them, but I think they are on the bio on the sheet, so you can actually have a look at that as well. His current work that he's doing for his doctoral degree, which we will be talking a bit about today, and I can say what it's called and all that kind of stuff. Okay, it's currently called LEB. which is a change of title, which we'll kind of ask him about at some point. So please welcome the two guests. I've got a bunch of questions, and depending on how good the questions are and their answers are, we'll probably talk for about 50, 60 minutes, and I'm hoping that they do most of the talking. And then we'll have about half an hour or so for questions and answers. So line up those difficult ones in particular we would particularly like.
Any questions so far?
I'd like to start. This event kind of came about because of the initiative and energy of Mohammed. As you know, he has copious amounts of energy. I want to begin by asking, to paraphrase the famous Australian tourism ad of 10 years ago or so, not where the bloody hell are we, but why the bloody hell are we here?
I'll start actually by telling you all a joke which probably most of you have heard, especially if you're from Granville Boys High School. How many LEBs does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 51. One to change it and 50 to stand around and watch and say, "Hectic cars, yeah, you're doing a good job, bro." Look at this guy up here, bro. And so to answer your question honestly, first, I'll actually say that the reason we're all here is because I really wanted to meet Ghassan Haj, and I needed 50 LEBs to come and watch it and say, "Hectic cars, look at this guy up here."
So this is kind of like a date night then, really.
Yeah, a public one. I first heard about Ghassan's work in my memory. It actually came a lot sooner, but in my memory, Ghassan's work presented itself to me about 5 years ago when I was upstairs and my wife was downstairs working on her master's thesis. She was looking at representations of Arab Australians in films, popular films. And she said, "Hey, Mohammed, Ghassan defines whiteness as the fantasy position of cultural dominance born out of European expansion." And I should have listened. I should have paid more attention then, because my writing career was just starting off and I was appearing on a lot of panels and I was going from place to place picking fights with white people. And it turns out that in Australia, we really don't like the word white. So people were getting very defensive, accusing me of stereotyping, reverse racism, generalizing. And the way that usually manifests itself was by someone in the audience saying, define white, define white. But when it became really urgent that Gusson and I were in dialogue was when The Tribe was released, because I was afraid that without particular expertise in what I was writing about, the framing and the context would be disconnected from the vast majority of Australians. And so Giramondo, my publisher, sent Gusson a copy of The Tribe, a complimentary copy. And Gusson was so energized by the book that he wrote a response, an article in Overland, which you can find online, titled Writing Arab Australian Universes. It's really a masterpiece in its own right, because it doesn't just talk about The Tribe. It talks about, I think, a new frontier in engaging with Arab Australian literature. So regardless of whether you're interested in my work or not, please read Gusson's article. But there are thousands of people following Gusson's work, and there's not as many thousands, but a couple of thousand have been following my work. And among them, there's a small percentage of people who have been following both of us closely for the last couple of years. And so I felt that it would be a good opportunity to bring those people together to see a discussion between us.
Okay. So, Gusson, he's mentioned White Nation, so we have to talk about White Nation. It's 20-odd years since you were doing the work for that book, and it met with critical applause and criticism. Obviously still has relevance for many people, but I want to ask you, is it still relevant, the arguments made then, and what has changed in the Australia that we live in now?
Yes, well, I mean, it's really not up to me to say as much as the fact it is still being taught everywhere. It is still, I still keep getting emails of people who have just discovered. It's actually quite an amazing phenomenon, because I, as an academic writer, have moved away in terms of the problems I'm looking at and etc. a bit from it, but it keeps following me all the time. And there's no doubt that every time I go back to it, it's a very depressing experience. It's a depressing experience because I could have written it today. It's a depressing experience because it makes you face how minuscule is the function of writing in changing the social world. And so, in some ways, that's pretty healthy, in the sense that you sooner or later stop having too many grand illusions about yourself as a writer, thinking what I'm writing is going to change the world. And you start writing with a far more realistic sense of, oh, wow, three people might read me, and one of them might change their consciousness. Great achievement in that sense. But I have to say that I think what Muhammad said was very interesting, that he wrote The Tribe not knowing, not having a background in certain traditions, and I think that's probably why it was so good, because certain traditions weigh on you in a certain sense, especially the question of anti-racist writing, which by definition you have to write about those who are considered others while constantly thinking about those who are othering them. And that is, you are haunted by white people, as I define it in White Nation. And you're haunted by white people as you are writing. And what I liked about Muhammad's work is precisely this thing that I discovered more ethnographically, really, which is that there's a good dose of healthy narcissism among Lebanese, Arab, Muslims, in which at least an important dimension of their lives is not constantly sitting there waiting to hear what the next second-rate whitey is saying about them. And the fact that they live their lives without wanting to think about that. And so that healthy narcissism, which I was grappling with ethnographically, came out so nicely in Muhammad's work. And so that's why I'm here, very happy to be with the person I've just met for the first time and the person I've been meeting almost since I've arrived in Australia.
Okay. There are a couple of issues there that I want to come back to, but I want to jump back to Muhammad to ask about the thing that you're writing now, okay? The original title of it was White Nonsense, okay, which is a fairly obvious gesture towards White Nation. You changed that title. I'm interested to know, though, why you chose that title in the first place and why you changed and what it's got to do with Ghassan.
Okay. First, just to pick up from where Ghassan left off, do you know that while Ghassan appreciated the resilience, the creation of a resilient space in the tribe, that it exists not too concerned about what's happening in the outside world, most reviewers and intellectuals who were talking about it could not recognize that. In fact, one review which really popped out to me said, and they were praising me, so it wasn't a negative review, but they said that Ahmed has a love affair with ethnicity. And of course, that is a perfect example of what I would define as white nonsense or a strange white gaze on the normalizing experience of being an Arab Australian in the year 2015. And so for me, the concept of white nonsense, and this is a working title for my new book, but the concept of it emerged because when I began my professional arts career, it was actually moving into the performance arts scene in Sydney's inner west, where the vast majority of the arts practitioners are white, would be identified as white and left wing. And so I spent a lot of time in those communities watching artists, rolling around on the ground and calling it a dance, speaking gibberish and saying it's a language, making up a language on the spot. My limited perspective as a 19-year-old boy, often also I noticed what I saw to be performing poverty, performing being poor. And very quickly I was identifying that that particular community were generally not poor. And so because it was so hard for me to articulate what that behavior was, my colleagues and I began to call it white nonsense. But again, touching from my first point, it's actually very hard in Australia to talk about whiteness. People don't like it. And so it occurred to me that it was probably a more sensible position to take not to write from the lens of the community that I'm criticizing, but to write from the lens of the perspective that it's coming from, which is the lens of the Leb. And this is actually a complex term, which I'll just quickly explain. I use Ghassan Haj's work actually to explain it. In an important essay called Islam, Multiculturalism and the Ungovernable Muslim, Ghassan talks about the behavior in the late 90s, which was being described as Lebanese, and that was so irksome to so many Australians, was a hybrid formation. The word Leb for me wasn't necessarily being from a Lebanese background or being Lebanese. It was an Australian identity, which a lot of marginalized communities, particularly young men of Middle Eastern and Arab and Muslim background or appearance, were identifying with. I met a lot of young men of Indonesian background, Turkish background, who were calling themselves Lebs. And it's a hybrid formation. This is the last point I'll make, that is specific and unique to Australia. It's not an identity that you will find in the Middle East unless, to quote Ghassan, you met Arab Australians in the Middle East. And I can assure you that you're not going to find any Lebs in Lebanon saying, Shukaz, why being a gronk for? unless it's an Australian.
To tease that out a bit, though, a bit more, because the work that you're doing at the moment, it's actually structured around particular key events, and the sections are called drugs and drive-bys, gang rape, and war on terror. Now, at one level, the novel is not actually about those things, as they are understood as public events, but they're an important framework for the work itself, but also for presumably making sense of the Arab-Australian experience that you're referring to.
I use them subversively, but I'm very aware, actually, of the issues that were facing the Arab-Australian Muslim, predominantly Muslim community in the late 90s in the western suburbs of Sydney. And I'll just say, a bit of a plug for Writing in Society, we are a research centre who make the claim that you have to conduct serious doctoral research in order to write substantially as a creative writer, in which case Greg Noble and Ghassan's work is integral to my understanding of the Arab-Australian and Muslim-Australian identity and how we actually frame the discussion. But those concepts, gang rape, drive-bys, drug dealers, war on terror, were very prominent ways of identifying and relating to and essentializing the Arab-Australian and Muslim-Australian community in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so in subverting them, what I want to do is not actually say, and this falls into the idea of anti-racist rhetoric, is not say we're not bad, actually we're great, but look at those issues through complex intersections of race, class, gender and sexuality.
I have to say, if a PhD student comes to me and says, I want to write about white nonsense, my immediate reaction is a very classic supervisor thing, which is, it's too big a topic. I think it's interesting how the notion of white nonsense to me speaks to the fact that we're swimming in it and there's so much of it. And again, to that question of how do you negotiate a space where you exist. I've been reflecting recently about the fact that, you know, how that old saying, sticks and stones will hurt my bones, but words would never hurt me, whatever, I forget exactly. And interestingly, I thought, what if we take this seriously? What if we actually take this seriously? In the sense that people in white positions of power can discriminate against you. And you cannot stop them from having the power to discriminate with the same ease with which you can stop them from affecting you just by looking down at you. Not with the same. I think there is a lot of space for symbolic work to immunize racialized people from the racist gaze. And that is a much more realistic possibility for a writer than it is to stop discrimination, to stop people from getting jobs because of this or that, to stop. And so that work is symbolic work. And I think writing of this sort is very important.
Can I say, you know, earlier, Ghassan, you were saying that with White Nation, you know, if you met three people who have read it, you'd be surprised or impressed, and if one can talk about it with you. Do you know, the best claim I can make for your work and for Greg's work, by the way, if you get a chance, read it. I would, White Nation, but there's a whole bunch of other books that Ghassan's produced. Greg Noble, one of the most important books that shaped my identity as a young man was Kebabs, Kids, Cops and Crime, which again is still relevant today. But do you know, your work, if it impacts one person who is a serious creative writer, then what we're seeing is the way creative work can re-engage and reimagine the world because of academic work, which is why we're always making the claim at the center that our creative work needs to be taken seriously, not just by the governing bodies, but by writers who usually consider creative writing a romantic self-expression that doesn't require anything but heart and love.
Sure, but I think still the problematic of the cyclical repetition of racism, the fact that we continuously find ourselves in exactly the same situations wherein, to me today, raises what I think is one of the most important anti-racist tasks, which is the work of consolidation. What does it mean to consolidate? What does it mean to ensure that whatever gain you have made is not going to be lost in 10 years' time? That is a labor which has never been done in a very conscious way. But I think today to me, it's so crucial, that idea of how do you structure what is an event, what is a moment of resistance, how do you structure it in the face of an apparatus which is destructuring even the most structured things, even citizenship, which we thought, you know, baseline, nobody will touch citizenship. This is it. Citizenship. And now you still have someone who will come and say, okay, well, you're on shaky grounds here. You're not even can guarantee that much. And so that work of consolidation is very crucial.
So how do you do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have an answer or an idea or some
advice? I'm defining it as can be answered in a question, it wouldn't be a problem. Yeah. I think it's a space. It's a space where a lot of thought has to be put into and debated.
I want to go back to the question of change, because you said White Nation could be written today, and in a sense nothing has changed and we keep returning to the same spot. But significant things have changed have happened, I should say. So we're coming up to the anniversary of the Cronulla riots, 9/11, gang rapes that you talked about, you know, various other terrorist attacks and so on and so forth. There have been significant things that have happened in that space. Yeah. I think there are a couple of questions that I want to ask around that. One is that they have in some ways reshaped the Australian imaginary. Yeah. And so one, I think, important point is that while your work has been mostly talking about the Arab-Australian experience, to use that cliche, in fact, most of your work has actually been talking about Australia, particularly in terms of White Nation and the Australian imaginary, the way you know, the mainstream or whatever you want to talk about it. So have things changed? And I want to tie that particularly to the question of racism, because in fact you argued in a paper a couple of years ago that you talked about the varieties of racism in Australia, and argued that in fact racism has changed. But instead of using the conventional academic argument about old racism based on biological differences to new racism based on cultural differences, you had a different set of categories. And you also kind of made the nice point that I think you argued that Pauline Hanson was in fact not typical Australian racism, whereas John Howard was. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what were you getting at there? And has racism changed in Australia?
You have to remind me now of that paper. But I mean, I just what comes to my mind immediately is something I'm working on now, since obviously. And so I will reply with the change I'm thinking about now, which has a link to the Cronulla riots and a little bit to Hansen, which is the role of the mob in racism. And so we often think of racism as either the state racism or structural racism or et cetera. And so the Cronulla riot brought out the question, what is the role of the mob? How do you theorize and think about the impact of the racist mob in history, which is a very particular thing. Going a bit academic technical here, but in a lot of Foucauldian literature, influenced by Foucault, working on governmentality, you always have this idea that there's the government and there's the people, and the government governs technically. But what does it mean, for instance, to govern through the mob? What does it mean to mobilize the mob to do the work for you? Now, this takes us, of course, to the history of fascism, how mobs do political work. And so how and when does a state either makes a mob kill or lets a mob kill? Or in the Australian situation, maybe it didn't let the mob kill, but it let the mob do violence. Or some might say it made it engage in violence. And so this relationship between the state and the mobilization of the mob is interesting because, and I'm sure some of you will say, but it only happened once. And what's interesting is precisely the fact that it only needs to happen once for internalizing the consciousness that the mob might get you. And this is the idea of a racist war here. You know, in classic games of deterrence, you don't want to deploy your nuclear forces. You just want to keep them in the background and say, I've got them. I've got them. Watch out. And the mob plays this function. The mob says, we've shown you that we can deploy the mob on you in Cronulla. So bloody watch out. And they don't have to do it more than once. And so the question of what does it mean today on the psyche of a person who is affected by living through white people, what does it mean? How does Cronulla weigh on you? I like to think about it in this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a particular thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is that it goes back to the category of white nonsense, which is there was a all the kind of the demonstrations by Reclaim Australia and associated organisations. One of those kinds of slogans and posters that keeps appearing is about the Islamicisation of Australia, and that Sharia law is about to take over. Now, I can't imagine any more nonsensical idea than that in the Australia that we live in, and yet it has a kind of a purchase. So what I'm interested in is asking is, what has happened to make people think that is a possibility, that is a legitimate thing to be worried about?
I'd like to hear you first, Professor. I would...
But they, yeah, okay. Yeah. I've talked a little bit, so
it's a privilege to hear you speak.
Well, you know, histories of fantasies of reversal is a history of its own. Colonialism, from day one, even when colonialism was very healthy, at its healthiest moment, if you look at English colonialism in India, when English lorded in a big time, there were writers imagining how the Indians are going to reverse the equation, and the Indians are going to be actually colonizing the English. And so you have this amazing literature imagining what is called imaginary reverse colonialism. And so what is the source of this imaginary? I mean, there's lots of debates about it. Some of it actually link it to some kind of like original colonial guilt, that colonists, despite the fact that they work hard on showing that they're not affected by the fact that they are morally bankrupt, that they've stolen land, killed people, done everything immoral that is possible, and then after having been the most immoral possible, then they come and tell you, we are the paragons of morality, and we can give you lectures about morality. And so in that process, despite that, there's something that nags them all the time. And that original acts of theft, etc., keeps gnawing at their very being and produce these kind of fantasies of fears. Mm-hmm. Now, I can go on, but I want to stop here. And so just go, because take me somewhere. I'll go to it later.
Well, I'll pick up where you're stopping, because the question about, I mean, the way you asked the question, Greg, is it's insanity. It's imagined, this fear of Islamicization of the country, and extremism and radicalization is going to take over. And so it does, to me, very clearly tie in with the idea of a white nation fantasy, which sees the white nation as the inherent state of Australia, and other identities as objects to be governed and dictated within that space. Do you know, though, that when I was a punch bowl boy 15 years ago, and I don't want to sound like an apologist for this, but do you know there was a bomb threat maybe once a month at my school? It never attracted any media attention or any police officers. It was, and I'm not exaggerating to get a laugh, but it was someone's cousin trying to get his boy out of an exam. And it usually took about half an hour. We would be evacuated from the school and brought back in. Like I said, I'm not excusing that kind of behavior, but do you know, just calling this event radical literature without taking seriously the language surrounding the media and the politicians at the moment meant that I didn't expect a response from schools saying, what is this going to be about? Because the language is transformed in an imaginary state. But of course, we're seeing the power of language. And just one more thing about Reclaim Australia. Do you know, my brother, about 2 weeks ago, who runs a camping and army disposal business, sent me a text message saying, put it on TV, our customers are on the news. And so I turned it on Channel 7 Sunday night, and there was a segment on Reclaim Australia, and the organisers of Reclaim Australia were seen marching, protesting against Muslims and third world looking people in a very military persona, wearing outfits, military outfits that they bought from my father's shop and my brother's shop, and waving Australian flags that they bought from our shop. And so I called my brother and I said to him, bro, do they know you're Muslim? And then he goes, no. And I said, well, why don't you tell them? And then he goes, they spend a lot of money.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
Oh, you want to respond? No, please.
No,
that's a conversation between you guys. I'm just giving the word.
Well, I mean, sort of like some of what you said links to what was what I'm really wanting to say in relation to Islamophobia. Because one of the things I've been talking about, this fear of reversal, is actually something I'm working on now for that book that which title Greg loved, which is Are Racists Responsible for Global Warming? Now, one of the interesting things about fantasies of reversal is that you also see them in relation to the domination of nature. And so ever since we've been dominating nature, we have had fantasies of nature getting stuck back into us. So Planet of the Apes, even Hitchcock, birds, the birds, sort of like now, different quality. So there's always these fantasies of reversal that come back. And then what is interesting to me is that there's always people who will come and say, don't worry, don't be scared. There's nothing to be scared about. Now, one of the things that really interests me about Islamophobia is that a lot of, and I'm not saying all, but a lot of the critiques of Islamophobia is of this genre, which is, hey, don't be scared. The Muslims are not scary. And to me, as I was writing, I stopped at one point and I said, well, why the hell shouldn't they be scared? Why is it my function to sit down and pat white colonialists and tell them, don't be scared? Why shouldn't they be bloody scared? I want them to be scared. If you're a white colonialist, be bloody scared, and the more scared you are, the better. Now, I think there is something scary about a scarved Muslim woman. I think there is something scary about... I think it's scary to white colonialists. It's scary because it puts you face to face with someone who says to you, I'm not going to bloody assimilate to you, piss off. A Muslim woman puts a scarf and says, I'm living my life. I'm not doing anything to actually sort of like attract attention or anything. But notice, the fact is, sometimes you live your normality and your normality is out of place. Just the mere fact that you're normal is out of place in somebody else's normality. And now this dominant normality comes and says, I'm scared of your normality. And I want to say, well, yeah, be scared, piss off. Why should I sit down and work some kind of like psychological trick on you? No, be scared. And hopefully there'll be more and more reasons you'll be scared until we get rid of you. That is the idea that we always work with as anti-colonialists. We want to get rid of white colonial culture. What's this idea that suddenly, I mean, you know, this idea that Frederick Jameson, a cultural critic, said it's become more habitual today and possible to imagine the end of the world rather than imagine the end of capitalism. And I think there's a truth in this, but I think it's also a kind of like ethic. We're no longer willing to work with the idea that we want the end of something nasty. You know, colonialism is bloody nasty, as I started by saying. It's immoral, it robs, etc., and it's continually doing it again. Why don't I want it to be scared?
Can I step in there?
No.
Because I want to ask Muhammad specifically about the principle. okay, which at one level could be read as a kind of a counter-narrative to the panic stories of Islamophobia. It offers a kind of a narrative which says actually Muslims can be good too, and they can be tameable, you know, they can kind of...
Yeah.
So what... And I know you've had a particular reaction to the principle, but it's kind of interesting listening to Ghassan talk about this particular fantasy, which at one level seems it's a different kind of fantasy, but in fact it actually connects very, very clearly to what he's talking about.
I can't begin to emphasise how much it relates to what you're talking about in regards to fear. I just have to set up the context. So... I imagine most people here have either seen the principle or at least heard about it, SBS program set in a fictional world, Boxdale High School, which strangely sounds like and looks like Punch Bowl. there were rumours at the time that the principle was loosely based on the life of Jihad Dib, but then, of course, at the end, it's exposed that he's gay, and we didn't want to associate that with Jihad Dib's reputation, so SBS was panicking. And that's kind of the experience that I had talking to producers about the show. Now, as a complementary project to the principal, SBS had an idea that they would get writers from the western suburbs of Sydney of diverse backgrounds to write true stories from their high school experiences for a podcast series. It's actually on the SBS website for anyone who's interested. I have a piece there, and a few other writers who are in this room, Luke Carman, Tomasz Nohokin, have pieces. But instead of me writing what I consider to be a complimentary piece, I wrote what I felt was a response piece. And when I met with the producers who were supposed to give me advice on how to write my piece, instead what they copped was an attack on how badly they stuffed up the principle. So here's my issue with it. That the space that they created, the world, the high school world, it's a very dark, very desolate, very miserable space. And the boys that are represented are aggressive, they're hostile, they're unhappy, and there has to be some kind of transformation. That's the kind of classic story that we hear about these young men. And what they left out for me, which was really obvious, is the joy, the pleasure, the irony that exists within those schools. And of course, you've got a few young people from those from similar schools here today who can attest to the jubilation that you experience from day to day in those spaces. And it was baffling to me that a group of producers who would be categorized as white middle class can go into a space like that and spend time researching the community and not see how much joy and irony and pleasure the boys have from day to day. And I spend a lot of time trying to work out how it happens, how they can go in and not see it. And this is my theory, my conclusion is, they do see it, but they just can't face up to it. They can't admit it. They can't come to terms with it because it contradicts everything that they know to believe, which is at the bottom of every working class and underclass ethnic male is a middle class white kid yearning to break free. And so they can't really comprehend the possibility that those young men could possibly be happy. And so my work was responding not by creating a positive alternative responses, but creating more nuanced responses where young men practice what you write about extensively in Kebabs, Kids, Cops and Crime, a protest masculinity, where they're actually performing a type of aggression because it's empowering if you're a racialized and marginalized identity.